today we are very fortunate to have Professor Earhart with us to do the training today, and he's truly a speaker that needs no introduction. I had an attorney actually email me, is it the Earhart? And yes, it is. It's in the, I was going to say in the flesh, but I guess we have his voice anyways. I promise that he's a real person. He's a professor at Florida State University, where he teaches torts evidence, trial practice, and trial evidence. He's obviously the author of Florida Evidence, the book that all of you have and probably use on a, if not daily basis, a weekly basis. Liz has listed his many accolades in the email, so I don't want to necessarily go through all that, but I do want to just thank him again for doing this for us, and you guys should have received materials with the phone number, so you will have an outline of what he's going to deliver, and I'm going to hand it over to him.
Well, thank you. What I'm going to try to do this noon is to talk about hearsay and the hearsay exceptions that I think probably you run into the most frequently, and then talk a little bit about Crawford against Washington, the new confrontation case that at least in your cases that have confrontation issues substantially change the rules. As you all remember, hearsay in the evidence code is defined in 90.801 as an out-of-court statement offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. There are two parts to that definition, and both parts of the definition must be present. Out-of-court statement offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. The Florida Supreme Court and the Florida appellate courts have fairly well defined what an out-of-court statement is. And that's an out-of-court statement by anybody, including a witness who testifies during the trial. What we want is a witness who comes to court and says, I remember this is what happened. Not, I remember telling so-and-so that this is what happened. We want the witness to testify based on their personal knowledge. And so what the Florida Supreme Court and appellate courts have said is that out-of-court statements by anybody, including witnesses who testify. And that's fairly simple. The harder question, I think, for judges and lawyers and law students is the second part of the equation, and that is offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. Hearsay is only inadmissible when the out-of-court statement is offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. What does that mean? The truth of what is said in the out-of-court statement. When the out-of-court statement is offered to prove the truth of what is said in that out-of-court statement, then it is inadmissible. Can the hearsay objection be avoided by simply offering the out-of-court statement for some purpose other than its truth? And the answer is perhaps. The majority of these cases come from the criminal law, and a lot of them involve, for example, police officers who testify in Earhart's criminal prosecution for possession of cocaine, that I received a tip from a confidential informant that at noon in late May, there would be a guy in Tallahassee talking into a speakerphone who had 50 pounds of cocaine in his briefcase under his desk. All right, we got a police officer testifying about a confidential tip that they received about Earhart having 50 pounds of cocaine in his briefcase. Well, what the confidential informant said is clearly an out-of-court statement. Well, if it's offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted, then it's hearsay. Well, the prosecutors routinely respond, well, Judge, we're not offering it to prove the truth of the matter asserted. We're offering it to show why Earhart was arrested. We're offering it to show a logical sequence of events. And what the Florida appellate courts have repeatedly said, and the status loss case is just one of the more current cases, at the bottom of the first page of my outline, the non-hearsay purpose for which the evidence is offered must be a relevant purpose. And in a criminal case, we don't care why Earhart was arrested. We don't care why the officers went to the scene of the crime. What we care about in a criminal case is, did the defendant commit these particular criminal acts? So you can't avoid the hearsay rule simply by offering the hearsay statement for some other purpose if that purpose isn't relevant and isn't material. The hearsay exceptions, I think, don't cause as much problem. They are fairly clear and fairly straightforward. But I think the problem that lawyers run into is they failed to lay the necessary foundation through testimony at a trial or hearing to demonstrate that a particular hearsay exception is applicable. The two that I'd like to spend time on that I think you may run into the most frequently are the child abuse victim exception and the business record exception. 90.80323 first. What 90.80323 provides, and I'm on the third page of my materials if you have them, is that a statement of a victim of child abuse, first a victim of child abuse, who is 11 or less, is admissible as an exception to the hearsay rule if the court finds, in a case-specific finding, that the statement is reliable, and that either the victim testifies at trial or is demonstrated to be unavailable, and if the victim is unavailable, that there be evidence to corroborate that the abusive act indeed occurred. All right, that's all clearly, fairly straightforward. Victims of abuse are 11 or less, case-specific finding of reliability, child either testifies or is unavailable, and if unavailable, there has to be evidence to corroborate that the act occurred. All right, first real issue here that there has been no authority on until a year and a half ago is 11 or less when? Is it the time the statement is made, or is it the time of the trial or hearing when the statement is offered? Because obviously a child can be 11 at the time the statement is made and be 12, 13, or 14 at the time of the hearing. And what Blanton says from the 5th DCA, which was there in the third page of my materials, is that it's the time the statement was made, not the time of trial, but the time the statement was made. And there are no cases, no other cases in Florida on that issue that I am aware of. There must be a case-specific finding of reliability by the judge. That means that the judge cannot simply say that I find that this statement is reliable, but must make a finding in the record as to why that particular statement is reliable. And the case law, and I've got most of it in my book, but Townsend in particular spells out a lot of the factors that are appropriate for the judge to consider in determining whether or not this particular statement is reliable. All right. So if we have a reliable statement of a victim who's 11 or less, That statement is only available if the victim either testifies or is demonstrated to be unavailable. That means if whoever is offering the exception doesn't want the child to testify, the statement is not going to be admissible under that hearsay exception, because the child either has to testify or be demonstrated to be unavailable. So that have to lay a foundation that one of the types of unavailability in 90.803.23 is present. And as you know, that includes a demonstration that if the child testifies, there's a substantial likelihood that the child will suffer severe emotional distress if he or she has to testify. And that is probably going to require, not necessarily, but probably going to require some sort of expert testimony. And it can't just be generally that children of this age are going to suffer this kind of emotional stress or trauma, but this particular child in this particular case would so suffer. All right, so if the child doesn't testify, can't be shown to be unavailable, 90.803.23 is not applicable. If the child is demonstrated to be unavailable, then there must be corroboration, independent evidence to corroborate that the abusive act occurred. All right, what is corroboration? Well, first, the case is down at the bottom of the third page and the top of the fourth. Corroboration of what? Corroboration says Gallicani, I guess is a pronunciation, from the fourth ECA, that the abusive act occurred. Not just that there was an opportunity to commit the abusive act, but that the abusive act occurred. On the fourth page of the materials, there are a couple of different principles that the DCAs have pointed out. First, the DCAs have said that you can't corroborate for the purposes of 90.803.23 by using other hearsay statements made by the child. In the RU case, we read the word other in the rule as denoting evidence derived from a source other than the child victim's own statements. In Rainer, the first DCA said that the defendant's out-of-court statements that the abusive act occurred can be considered on the issue of corroboration. So the defendant confesses, essentially, or the parent or step-parent makes a statement to somebody that says, yes, this abusive act occurred, that would be sufficient corroboration, could be sufficient corroboration under the Rainer case to have the child statement admitted under 90.803.23. Finally, in the Palazzolo case, the question was, on cross-examination, could you admit these statements without laying the foundation normally required under 90.803.23? And the answer in the Palazzolo case was no. If you're going to try to get these child hearsay statements in, that you've got to lay the necessary foundation, whether it be on direct examination or whether it be on cross. There are some recent cases that I didn't put in the materials that, as I reviewed this morning, I thought that I should have, and those are some excited utterance cases. You all know that excited utterances are admissible under 90.803.2, when the declarant is in an excited or stressful state, and the statement relates to whatever caused that excited or stressful state. And the cases that have arisen have been cases where there has been some delay between the event causing the excited state and the statement itself. If we have a fairly contemporaneous statement, there's been no problem. But what happens if a child in an excited manner comes to a parent, a teacher, or what have you, and makes an excited utterance? They clearly are excited, and the statement concerns whatever event it is that caused that excited state. Well, what the Florida appellate courts have said is, first, that if the declarant, if the child has lost the excited state, a statement is not admissible under 90.8032 because there's been time for reflection and time for conscious thought. And simply regaining the excited state does not qualify a statement for admission under that provision. The significant case to me is Hutchison against State, which I didn't put in the materials, which is 882 Southern 2nd 943. That case, it was a murder case, and the victim, the night before the murder, told a friend that she had just had a big fight with the defendant. And when she made the statement, she was in an excited state. There were either 20 or 30 minutes between the, quote, big fight and the time the statement was made. And what the Florida Supreme Court said was, in that Hutchison case, that testimony relating to the victim's statement was not admissible as an excited utterance because the prosecution didn't lay a foundation to show that the victim's excited state continued from the time of the event through the time the statement was made. In other words, if there's any delay between the event and the statement, it's necessary that there be a foundation that the excited state continued from the event until the statement was made. All right, business records. And I think business records have been a problem in Florida. The business record exception is in 90.8036. I like to say that the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur doesn't apply, because I teach torts as well as evidence. And I always get kind of quizzical looks. And what do you mean by that? Well, business records don't speak for themselves. That's what res ipsa loquitur says. The thing speaks for itself. Business records don't speak for themselves. Not everything that says IBM or not everything that has a business name on the top of it is admissible as a business record under the business record exception. The idea of business records, the reliability of business records, comes from the effort and expense that businesses invest in keeping reliable records for their own purpose. And if a business record meets the test of reliability and regularity, then it is admissible without the necessity of calling the people with knowledge of what is recorded in that record. In Florida, there are four elements required for a business record to meet the business record exception. And the Jackson case from the 4th ECA on the 5th page of my material spells those out. The record must be made at or near the time of the event. It must be contemporaneous. By or from information transmitted by a person with knowledge. record must be kept in the regularly conducted business activity, and it was a regular practice of that business to make such a record. So that the foundation is laid by someone from that business, and business is very broadly defined. The state of Florida is a business. Nonprofits are a business for the purpose of the business record exception. Someone with knowledge of the way that enterprise keeps its records, and that this record meets all four of those qualifications. And normally that's going to be someone from the records section. It doesn't have to be if that person has knowledge of the way this particular record is generated. Now, 3 years ago, the Florida legislature amended the business record exception to provide that foundation could be demonstrated by a certification or affidavit that met the requirements of 90.902.11, sub 11, which essentially says that the record custodian can make a certification that this particular record meets all four of the requirements for the business record exception, and then you don't need the record custodian to testify. All right. That's all pretty basic and pretty general. There are at least two or three recurring issues with business records. Because a record generally meets these requirements does not mean that the entire record is admissible. All right. First, the record must be based on the personal knowledge, of an employee of the business. An entry in the, not the entire record, but an entry in the record must be based on the personal knowledge of an employee of the business. And if that entry is not based on the personal knowledge of an employee of the business, then it doesn't have the necessary reliability and is not admissible under the business record exception. The Reichenberg case, which I imagine is a significant case for y'all, reports of investigators of the Child Protection Team and Department of Children and Families, which contain witness interviews. Are they admissible under the business record exception? And I think the Fifth DCA was absolutely right when it said no, the witness interviews were not, because no employee had personal knowledge of the matters in those interviews. It was the witnesses, the non-employees, who had personal knowledge of the matters included in those records. You've got it. The entry has to be based on personal knowledge. So if that witness statement is going to be introduced, the witness is probably, not necessarily, but probably going to have to testify. I say probably because what we have, for example, in these reports is double hearsay. You've got the report itself, which part of it will be admissible as a business record, that part based on the personal knowledge of the employee, and part which is not admissible under the business record exception. And by the way, you can redact the inadmissible part if that's the way the court rules and only admit the admissible part. But double hearsay or multiple hearsay or hearsay within hearsay is not necessarily inadmissible. Rather, what has to occur is that there has to be an exception that is applicable for each level of hearsay. In other words, if we have this report of children and families containing witness statements, You've got the report itself, which could be admissible as a business record or maybe admissible as a public record, containing these witness interviews. Well, if those witness interviews would independently come in under a hearsay exception, for example, if we have a statement of a party, is that statement of a party contained in that report going to be admissible? Well, anything said by the adverse party is admissible against the adverse party under 90.80318. And so if it was a statement of an adverse party, for example, if we had, I'm not sure about all of your proceedings, but termination of parental rights, if it's a statement of a parent that's being offered against the parent, it would that hearsay within hearsay would be independently admissible as an admission by the party opponent. Well, what if this business record contains opinions? Are opinions in business records, whether they be hospital opinions, medical records, or whatnot, are they admissible without the necessity of calling the person who has rendered that opinion? Well, the statutory language itself in 90.8036 says that it uses three or four different terms, and then concludes, or opinions or diagnoses contained in a business record are admissible under that exception. So certain statements of opinion and certain diagnoses, are admissible under the business record exception without the necessity of calling the person who rendered that opinion, the expert who rendered that opinion. Now, does that mean that all opinions in a business record are admissible under the business record exception? Well, there aren't a lot of cases in Florida on this, but what the cases say is it depends on the opinion. If it is a relatively routine and lower level opinion, and most of these are medical opinions, such as patient appears flushed, that kind of an opinion is probably admissible without the expert testifying. But what the Bradley case at the bottom of the fifth page and a few other cases have said is that if it's any kind of a sophisticated opinion, then the opinion should be excluded by the trial judge if it's in the business record, if it's in the hospital or medical report, unless the expert who renders that opinion testifies at the trial or hearing. But under 90.403, there is too much danger of confusing the issue, misleading the trier of fact, or unfair prejudice to the opposing party. The final issue that seems to me that can occur in some of your cases is, what about expert witness reports? And I know you have such things as guardian ad litem reports and so forth that there's a statutory provision for, social investigations. But assume that there is no statutory provision. Is an expert witness report admissible, or is it hearsay? Well, there's a body of case law in Florida and elsewhere that says that a business record which is generated in anticipation of litigation generally lacks the necessary trustworthiness to be admitted under the exception. In other words, the cases would draw a distinction. Say you had a slip and fall in a McDonald's, and you had there is a difference in the records of the number of hamburger buns that were delivered in the morning, and a incident report where an assistant manager comes out in front after somebody slipped on a greasy French fry and takes names and interviews witnesses. In the latter, there is almost a self-serving purpose on the part of McDonald's or whoever the business is, because they know that litigation is possible, if not probable. And therefore, what the Florida courts have said is that not that there's a per se rule, but when business records are generated in anticipation of litigation, the trial court should be very careful in admitting them. And the presumption, it's not a true presumption, but the presumption is they're inadmissible. That's a long-winded explanation of what about expert witness reports. And there aren't a lot of cases in Florida, but there are two or three recent ones. McElroy, which is on page 6, is one of them that says, well, why are expert witness reports written? Well, for purposes of litigation. That's the only reason the expert writes a report. And therefore, that expert witness report ought to be treated like all other business records. And if it's generated in anticipation of litigation, it should not be admitted. Therefore, the expert should testify, not simply offer that expert witness report. All right. Well, now, if we're talking about Department of Children and Families, don't we have the public record exception? I mean, we in Florida are either fortunate or misfortunate enough to have the world's broadest Public Record Act in Chapter 119. Almost everything in Florida is a public record for the purposes of the Public Record Act. That's right. But we have a very narrow public record hearsay exception. Most public records are admissible under the business record exception. Some public records are admissible under the public record exception. Well, if they're admissible under the business record exception, why even have a public record exception? And the answer to that historically has been that we do not require the same foundation for documents admitted under the public record exception as we do under the business record exception. The record custodian or the like does not have to testify. The documents do speak for themselves. There are two and only two kinds of documents that are admissible under the public record exception in Florida. 90.803 sub 8. The first are public records which set forth the activities of the office or agency. And how this language has been interpreted, and it's the same under the federal rules, is that applies to the internal kinds of operations of the public agency. The payroll records, the leave records, and all those kind of mundane, everyday, internal things that any organization has to record. And the second kind of public record that is admissible under the public record exception is a public record when there is both a duty imposed by law on the public agency to observe and a duty imposed by law to make the record. My favorite case, I didn't include in these materials, it was a case that the first DCA decided a number of years ago from Jacksonville. And it was an intersection collision between a railroad and a railroad in a car, and of course the railroad crushed and horribly injured the driver of the car. And the railroad defense was that the driver of the car was negligent in approaching the intersection with the tracks. And to establish the duty of the motorist who approaches an railroad intersection, the counsel was pretty creative, went down to the driver's license office and got a Florida driver's license handbook. One of those things that tells you that you're supposed to drive on the right side of the road and stop when there's a red light and what the shape of all the signs are. It had in there some language about the duty of a driver in approaching a railroad intersection. And what the first DCA said was that even though that book was published by the Department of Highway Safety, it was not admissible under the public record exception. They said, we have looked in the Florida statutes and have gone so far as to look in the Florida Administrative Code, and we can find no duty imposed by law on the Department of Highway Safety to publish that Florida driver's license handbook. They just do it. And therefore, Judge, you shouldn't have let in that Florida driver's license handbook. All right. Suppose there is such a record where there's both a duty to the part of the agency to observe and a duty to make the record. Again, it might, under the public record exception, it must be based, that record or that entry in the record must be based on the personal knowledge of an employee of that public agency. And again, in that Reichenberg case, which contained a witness interviews, reports from the Department of Children and Families, the witness interviews were based on the personal knowledge of the witnesses, not on the personal knowledge of any employee of the department. The witnesses were there. The witnesses knew what happened. The employees of the department just came along later. And so I think the public record exception is rarely going to be the basis upon which any document can be admitted under the public record exception. I think a much stronger and much more likely case to admit these records is under the business record exception. All right, now the fly in all this ointment, and the difficulty that you are going to be facing in some of your cases, and generally are being faced in the criminal area, is when confrontation applies, termination of parental rights. I understand confrontation applies. 2 years ago, the United States Supreme Court rewrote the rules and has caused great uncertainty about the use of hearsay in any proceeding when confrontation applies. Crawford against the United States, which is at the bottom of the sixth page and really the rest of the materials, was the case decided by the United States Supreme Court. And what the United States Supreme Court said was that they were going to reinterpret the Confrontation Clause, or maybe give it its true interpretation or true meaning. And what the Supreme Court said was that when testimonial hearsay was offered in a proceeding when confrontation was present, testimonial hearsay, they invented that term, that testimonial hearsay was only admissible if the hearsay declarant was demonstrated to be unavailable, and if unavailable, there was an opportunity for cross-examination prior to the time that the testimonial hearsay was offered. The problem with the decision is that the court did not define in any meaningful way any of those three requirements. What was testimonial? Hearsay. What is unavailability? And when is there a significant opportunity for pretrial cross-examination? What the Supreme Court did say was that police interrogation is that statements made during police interrogation are testimonial and therefore are subject to Crawford. And what they said in a footnote was, however, interrogation is, we're not using that in its legal sense, we're using it in a broader sense, but we're not telling you for sure when there is police interrogation. Just an aside, if the child or if a witness testifies at trial and is subject to cross-examination at trial, there is no confrontation problem with the admission of that person's hearsay, out-of-court hearsay statements. Courts said that, the Florida courts have said that since Crawford two or three times, so that if a child or if someone else testifies at the trial or hearing and is subject to cross at the trial or hearing, there's not a confrontation problem. Right. So we know that if it is testimonial hearsay, there must be a showing of unavailability. There must be a showing that there was an opportunity to cross-examine. If it is not testimonial hearsay, then these requirements are not required. All right. What do we know about what kind of hearsay is testimonial hearsay? Well, a big issue right now in Florida and around the country is, what about excited utterances? And excited utterances can come up in two ways. There's a bunch of 911 cases where somebody calls up the 911 operator in an excited way, makes a statement about what has happened either to them or to someone else. Or the police come out in response to a call or a complaint, and a witness or a victim makes an excited utterance to that police officer in response to that call, so-called field investigation. I think what I can say about that is the cases are all over the waterfront. We don't know for sure. Those excited utterances may or may not be hearsay. It may not be testimonial hearsay, but the United States Supreme Court in March heard oral argument on that excited utterance issue. They took both a 911 case and then they took a non-911 case where we had an excited utterance to the cops. And they will decide that issue by the end of June. So if you have that come up, there's going to be some definition to it by the end of June. The Florida Supreme Court has also taken that issue, but it's not going to do anything until the United States Supreme Court speaks. All right, so we have excited utterances. I think maybe the biggest case in this area is in your area is on the ninth page of my materials, Contreras. It's at 910 Southern 2nd at 901 from the 4th DCA. What happened in Contreras was that the child protection team conducted an interview with a child who was a suspected victim of abuse. And there was someone from the team who was interviewing the child. And, of course, in an adjoining room, through a one-way mirror was a police officer who was whispering questions to the interviewer. And they taped the interview with the child, and then they attempted to offer that tape, videotape of that interview. what the fourth DCA said, and I think the current cases around the country have said, is this was the kind of a statement that the United States Supreme Court intended to include within its definition of police interrogation. This was in police interrogation where the police officer was whispering questions to the child protection team interviewer to ask the child. And because this tape statement was testimonial, it was not admissible because the child was not shown to be unavailable and because there was no opportunity to cross-examine the child before the trial. Now, this case has been accepted. Contreras has been accepted by the Florida Supreme Court. They're going to take a look at it. But it raises two other issues in addition to what is testimonial. That is, what is unavailable? And what the fourth DCA said was that what was intended by Crawford was physical unavailability, not psychological unavailability. And therefore, simply because the child was going to suffer substantial emotional distress if the child had to testify at trial, was not unavailability for the purposes of Crawford. If that's the case, and we don't know that that's the case, but if that's the case and that is the law in the fourth DCA, then this taped interview with the child will not be admissible under Crawford because you can't show unavailability. All right. If Contreras is wrong, and it may be wrong, and the other DCAs may disagree with it, then the question is, is the opportunity to take a discovery deposition of the child sufficient to meet the requirement that the child, that the declarant or child, be subject to cross-examination before the trial? Well, on the last page of my materials, I've got Blanton and Lopez and Belvin and Contreras, four cases that disagree on that issue. Some of the DCAs have said the opportunity to take a discovery deposition meets that requirement. Others say it does not, and the Florida Supreme Court has taken that issue. I would simply say, I guess, the same thing that I say to the criminal bench and bar, and that is, we don't know for sure what Crawford means. If you have testimonial hearsay, be careful, because there is at least a possibility that the DCA in your area has got it wrong. Because there's only a few people in this country who know what Crawford means, and they're all in Washington. The clear preference under Crawford is for live testimony. And so I think today, if the child does not testify, and it is not a statement to a mother, father, teacher, or brother, but it's a statement to child protection team or to police officer, there are significant confrontation issues and risks if you offer that statement and the child does not testify. It is a real problem, I think, not only in your matters, but it throughout the proceedings in which confrontation applies.